Our son Wesley died needlessly, a victim of our imbalance and misuse of the Bible. We mistook presumption for faith, overstepping the proper bounds of God's sovereign plan for our son's life. Those are the comments of Larry Parker in his book, We Let Our Son Die. Larry Parker and his wife had initially believed, along with other faith healers, that their son's symptoms could be treated by prayer alone. When their son Wesley died of untreated diabetes, they expected him to be raised from the dead. Instead, Wesley was buried, and his parents were convicted on charges of child abuse and involuntary manslaughter, just one of many cases involving a collision between religious freedom and child welfare. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Do Christian Scientists, Jehovah's Witnesses, or members of any other religious denomination have the right to withhold medical care from their children? Is the state justified in mandating vaccinations or enforcing parents to allow their children to receive surgeries and other medical procedures deemed necessary for their survival? Joining us to explore the complicated and controversial legal issue of religion-based medical neglect is Sean Peters, historian at the UW-Madison, whose most recent book, published by Oxford University Press, is entitled When Prayer Fails, Faith Healing, Children, and the Law.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
It seems to me there are three things that come together here, any two of which coming together would be complicated enough. You have religion, you have the relationship between parents and their children, and then you have the law. It sounds like a real cauldron.
It's a volatile mix. I mean, religion in particular, in our public discourse about religion, and certainly when we talk about the law being a sort of statement of the way we think relationships between people and institutions should be regulated. When you throw in religion, it's something that most Americans feel strongly about one way or another. And it, as you mentioned, putting those things together, and certainly when the state attempts to intervene or interpose itself between parents and children, that's a very sensitive topic. So when you bring in religion with that as well, it can make for controversy and ambiguity. And I think that there is some ambiguity in the law currently that reflects how complicated that is.
I guess you could add a fourth element there too if you wanted to, and that would be medicine, which is a sort of a constantly changing, constantly evolving process. And, you know, I can't help thinking that if I had my choice between medicine and faith healing in the year 1800 – I might go with the faith healing.
I say that all the time when I talk about this stuff. You know, if it were a choice between being, you know, in my book I talked a little bit about Benjamin Rush, who was known as the remorseless master bleeder, they called him, who was the most famous signer of the Declaration of Independence, a prominent physician at the time. Bled people, pumped them full of mercury, did all sorts of this allegedly heroic medicine. And compared to prayer, I would have taken prayer as well. And that's important to keep in mind. I would never claim that medicine has all the – we now know that medicine has all the answers to everything, because that's absolutely not true. And I think that that's – if you want to have an honest discussion about these issues, you need to sort of come up with a complete picture of what prayer does for people, what medicine does for people, and have a conversation based on that. Sometimes we have this – it's sort of a binary where people will say medicine always works, and other people will say, well, prayer always works. And I don't find that a very satisfying conversation at all. And that's in the 19th century especially, that conversation changes because medicine just gets a lot better. The batting average of medicine improves significantly because of the advent of the germ theory of disease.
Before we talk about some of the cases that you outline in your book, can we talk about the extent of the problem? You have your opening chapter called Pointless and Preventable. And if we look at the one like that I opened with Wesley Parker dying of untreated diabetes, do you have any sense of how widespread the problem is of children dying for lack of medical care due to their parents insisting on withholding care?
Unfortunately, there's a lot of guesswork involved. people in these churches tend to live in somewhat more isolated communities. I mean literally isolated, sort of in the mountains out west, and just figuratively isolated. And we don't find out about these deaths usually. Reported deaths in instances of what we would call religion-based medical neglect of children, they might average 10, 12, 15 a year nationally. Everybody who's looked at that figure says, well, this is just really the tip of the iceberg. We don't really know because the parents involved in these cases, they don't run out to the coroner or the medical examiner and say, hey, my child died and we didn't treat him or her with medicine. Why don't you come and investigate and maybe prosecute us? So we don't know really the extent of it. And it's unfortunate. Some people have said that's one of the reasons why it hasn't gotten quite the attention that it might have otherwise, is that it's this sort of steady trickle of cases rather than, for instance, Jonestown in Guyana, right?
Right.
Almost 1,000 people died in one shot. We've had that many deaths from this, but they just haven't happened.
Now, that raises an interesting contrast, though, between children who are so dependent upon their parents and are not necessarily able to make a mature decision about how they want to be treated or healed, if you want to put it that way, and adults. Do we have any idea of how many adults actually choose to be cured by faith healing over medicine?
Not really. And legally, it's sort of a non-issue in the sense that if you're a competent adult, you can control the medical treatment or lack thereof, your own medical treatment or lack thereof. It's sort of a separate, distinct question in terms of the legal issues are just a lot different. And I think that the ethical issues are somewhat different too. I think most people would say, or at least most of the people I've spoken with about this, have said, you know, if it's your own body and you're controlling those decisions that affect you immediately, hey, it's your life. You can do with it more or less what you want. Children, I think, represent that there are a different set of issues when we're talking about children. We expect that parents will act in a way that serves the best interest of the child. And then the question becomes, well, what is the best interest of the child? Is it their physical well-being or is it their spiritual well-being? And those are separate but sort of interrelated questions. The parents involved in these cases would say spiritual well-being is paramount and that's what we care about. We're not going to privilege life on earth over life everlasting. And so if we make a decision to deny medical treatment to a child, it's based on our interest in sort of everlasting life. And if the child dies, it's God's will, everything that happens. And that's a theological question that I'm not smart enough to really address. But that it seems like that's a pretty convenient catch-all explanation. You could sort of explain anything by saying, well, it happened, therefore God wanted it to happen. I don't have any personal agency in that because it's what God wanted to have happen. I don't really find that to be a satisfactory answer. With diabetes, for instance, we know that insulin can mitigate diabetes. And so to say my diabetic child was denied insulin and it was just God's will, I don't really find that to be a satisfactory explanation.
Neither does the state, apparently.
Right. And you point to the Epistle of James and some other scriptural passages to show where many of these groups take their where they get their ammunition, I guess, for their belief.
One can use sacred texts, not only the sacred texts of Christianity, but a myriad of other faiths to justify lots of things. And there's certainly abundant references to spiritual healing practices, traditions throughout the Bible, the New Testament. The Gospels are a story of religious proselytizing and healing. It's all over the place. And so it's not a sort of wildly elastic reading of the New Testament to say that the New Testament sort of legitimizes or sanctions some of these practices. I think that many people would say, however, the danger in sort of narrowly and literally reading particular passages, this demonstrates the dangers of doing that. You mentioned this the sort of touchstone passage in the Epistle of James, which mentions, are any among you sick? Call the elders of the church, anoint the afflicted with oil, and so forth. And it is there in black and white in the Epistle of James, but to say we will just, therefore, we're sort of frozen in time in, you know, the first century AD when that was presumably written, and therefore sort of ignore, you know, the last 1900 odd years of scientific developments, I think, is troubling to a lot of people. And so there's certainly practical discussions that can happen, theological discussions that can happen too. And I try to avoid sort of having this discussion. You can battle Bible quotes forever.
Yes,
and
yes.
To me, it's a somewhat different discussion in terms of ultimate religious truth. And it's a discussion that it's interesting. It's important to know where spiritual healers come from, and I think it's important to respect where they come from. It's not, I don't think that they just sort of wake up one morning and say, I want to concoct some rationale for being cruel to my child. But by the same token, that's a conversation that will probably never really be satisfactory.
Now, how often is this faith healing a matter of this kind of passivity that you've described? Well, whatever happens, happens is God's will, versus active participation in some kind of a process that tempts through faith overcoming this.
I think it's usually more active. It's primarily active in the sense that we are going to – if I'm a parent in this situation, I'm going to do something that I will bring fellow members of my church to my home and we will engage in a religious ritual. I don't think it's normally, well, we just didn't do anything and we just think it's God's will. I mean, I do think that they believe that there is a anointment with oil, for instance. There are things that are done. However, the idea is ultimately it is up to a God to sort of decide what is going to happen and how it's going to happen.
The assumption seems to be for those more active healers that their faith is unerringly strong enough to – or let's say pure enough to affect the cure. So in other words, if you're a parent and you are trying through faith healing to heal your child, you're assuming that as a parent your faith is adequate for the job. Whereas, of course, you're acting on somebody else's behalf, which is the child.
I would say a spiritual healer would say not exactly. My faith – I have faith that God will resolve this the way that God wants. And hopefully it's going to work out in a way that will preserve the child's life. But my faith isn't necessarily automatically going to result in a positive sort of medical result. What I'm going to use my faith to do is just sort of implore God to do what God thinks
and to help
is
me
best. And maybe
cope
the,
with or live with whatever
exactly.
Happens.
And so – and if that means it's the child's death, then that's a positive – result. And that's what when you read about these cases, it's really disconcerting. After the death of a child, you would think, and as a parent, you know, if I were lost, I can't even imagine what it must be like emotionally. And parents will say, well, you know, that's it's what God wanted and I'm happy that it happened and now our child is in a better place.
And then they go on sometimes to have the same thing happen with a second child or a third child. Sort of you talk about in your book about some repeat cases
exactly.
where it doesn't lead to a change in behavior.
Exactly.
One of the groups that you talk about before we get to the Christian Scientists and Jehovah's Witnesses and some of the American cases, you talk about a group of people that I really didn't know much about that set some precedents in the British courts that affected things here in America. And that's a group called the Peculiar People.
Sure. And it's interesting to – as I started researching these cases, I sort of started backwards historically. I read about some contemporary cases and I sort of went backward and I wanted to know how did the law evolve? And as often happened, right, we have an Anglo-American legal tradition. We didn't sort of invent this stuff. We stole a lot of it from England. I kept seeing references in the late 19th century to these British cases involving this group called the Peculiar People. And they were I think that we would call them loosely fundamentalists. That's not an anachronistic term to apply to the early part of the 19th century. But I'm sure they were more or less British faith healers. And their cases were the first that really required the courts in a sustained way to address this issue. What happens not when you actively, you know, clobber somebody over the head and murder them, but what happens if – what is medical neglect legally? Is it manslaughter? Is it something else? And so in my book, what I tried to do is I just in a compact way tried to trace how that happened in England. That's sort of a prelude to what happened in the United States beginning in the later stages of the 19th century. But it's really – you could look at those cases in Britain in the 1850s and really just change the dates and the names. And it's almost exactly what we're actually still dealing with today. It's one of the things that interests me about this stuff is we tend to think of the evolution of law and public policy as being a neat, tidy kind of linear things. And eventually if we put our brain power together and we have a little bit of trial and error, we'll figure things out and then we can move on to the next problem. And that's actually not – has not happened at all. And the ambiguity and the murkiness of this issue, it's almost as murky today as it was in 1850s in London, more or less.
And in those instances in London, let me see if I can kind of provide a template for a standard case, would be child is somehow afflicted in an ongoing way. Neighbors perhaps become aware of this, call attention to it, to some kind of legal authorities who then intervene between parents and child.
Right. And it's important too, is one of the things that I find disturbing about these cases too, is that we're talking sort of after the facts usually. And it's one of the things that I try to foreground when I have this discussion is that even if we successfully prosecute parents, whether it's in Britain in the 19th century or in, you know, Wisconsin.
Too late to help the child.
It's too late to help the child. And that's one of the things that makes this even more complicated is that it's not – there are some things I talk about in the book and in cases in which authorities do find out about a child's illness before the child has expired. And that's those raise really interesting questions about, you know, can the state, for instance, if your church, your faith-healing church has a measles epidemic, can we take your child and vaccinate your child against your will if you're a parent?
Well, you know, it's a public health issue. You probably could.
I think – and generally I think the courts have said yes.
But if that child is languishing from malnutrition or diabetes or something that would not directly affect other people, I guess it gets a little tougher.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, but the fact is we just don't find it. It's the exception rather than the rule that we find about. And you can look at it historically that the state has been able to intervene before the death of the child. Usually what we're dealing with is a really – half-hearted prosecution of parents after their child has already died. Nobody really has any enthusiasm for doing that. The parents seem sincere. They seem well-meaning. They are doing what they think is best for the child. I don't think that that makes it legally justified, but it's just important to remember that they are doing what they think is best.
They're not a danger to anyone else
other than other children. Yeah, to their surviving children. And prosecutors don't necessarily want to go out of their way to prosecute people for engaging in religious conduct because that's not something that's sort of a minefield, right, politically in terms
of public, a no-win situation.
Public perception. Exactly.
You do talk about how this is – I mean this is not a child situation, but you talk about the polygamy cases and the Mormons with the, I think it was Reynolds or whatever the case is an important precedent in our country for showing that the government could intervene in terms of conduct.
Sure. Absolutely. When I have these sorts of discussions with people in public, I try to stress that sometimes it's frustrating for me. People think, well, we have – geez, we have the First Amendment. That means you can sort of do whatever you want in the name of religion. That's never been the case in American history. We have a long line of judicial precedent that has said there are – just in terms of any civil liberties, there are limits on speech. There's limits on assembly. There are all sorts of limits and there are limits on religion. There are things that you can't do. You can't just sort of say, well, it's my faith. And polygamy is the first and most probably the most important example of that. In the 1870s, the U.S. Supreme Court was faced with this issue of regulating plural marriage in Utah Territory. And they said, look, religious belief is sacrosanct. You can we can't – I'm not sure how anybody – how they would necessarily coerce you to think one way or another anyway. But conduct is another matter. And so we've seen over the next 130 or 40 years how that has worked out and courts have dealt with it in different ways. And the question is, so how sort of dangerous – is your conduct? Is your conduct – the Jehovah's Witness cases of the 1930s and 40s. You're just running around handing out leaflets and standing on the street corner. That doesn't really present a danger to public order, but polygamy does. And I talk about polygamy a lot because it again shows how difficult these things are to resolve because that was 1870, this Reynolds case that presumably laid to rest polygamy as a legal issue. We still have the FLDS and Warren Jeffs. We, we st- still have it today, and it's just driven the behavior underground. I've made this – I didn't make it so much in my book, but there are parallels here in terms of what happens when you have a sort of coercive legal regime. And with polygamy, the coercive legal regime did modify the behavior of mainstream Mormons.
Well, it had to do with statehood ultimately, didn't it?
Absolutely. It was completely – yeah, they realized that Utah would not be a state unless they gave up polygamy. But we still have it. We still have it. And we have it in a way that's even more pernicious, I think, than it was back then. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to regulate religion-based medical neglect of children, but I think that it's – we just need to be careful about what the ultimate result is and where we – as a practical matter, where we see it going. Because oftentimes people will say, well, we just need to put these people in jail and that'll be the end of it. And if we put enough people in jail, they'll just stop doing what they do and the problem will be solved. I know that's just not – absolutely not true. And as you mentioned, Emily, we have parents who have been jailed and then have come out of jail and have said, I'm going to do the same thing. Because I think in terms of I don't really care what the law says. God's law is the law that I care about. You can throw me in jail again and again and again. It doesn't matter. That's – as a public policy matter, that's a really hard thing to deal with, right? It's people basically saying God's law trumps, you know, temporal law.
Let's look at the law, children, and Christian Science when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Few faiths have been implicated in more cases of religion-based medical neglect of children than Christian Science. From Mark Twain's time to the present day, dozens of parents have been prosecuted for manslaughter, neglect, and other offenses after they chose to follow the teachings of Mary Baker Eddy. That Mark Twain, a legendary skeptic and certainly the foremost critic of Christian Science of his time, would caution against infringing on the rights of these parents illustrates just how perplexing cases involving the faith's healing practices could be. The overlapping legal and ethical challenges presented by such cases proved all the more complicated in the late 19th and early 20th centuries when scientific medicine was still establishing its credibility. With conventional medicine making rapid but sometimes uneven progress against illness, courts in that era struggled to determine if Christian Scientists should be held legally accountable when their shunning of physicians, a repudiation grounded in the fundamental tenets of their faith, apparently resulted in a child's injury or death.
That's a passage from the book When Prayer Fails, Faith Healing, Children and the Law by our guest, Sean Peters. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we are talking about faith healing, children's medical care, and the law. Sean, you were talking about in that passage about Mark Twain, who criticized the Christian Scientists but also warned against going too far in prosecuting them, which seems to kind of epitomize this tormented position people have had about what to do.
It did, sure. And Twain was, as I mentioned, the passage of a harsh and hilarious critic of Christian Science. And yet Twain sort of understood that the dangers of people claiming sort of ultimate truth, whether that's religious truth or scientific truth. And I think that Twain's comments about Christian Science sort of illuminate how slippery this kind of issue can be, where on one hand it's easy for us to say, hey, I don't think that prayer sort of has all the answers. But we know too that medicine doesn't – there are many things that medicine sort of hasn't been able to answer as well. And I think Twain touched on who is going to be ultimately responsible for the care of children. And we usually give – parents sort of are presumed to have that authority, and I think most of us would agree with that. And yet there are times when we need to – the state exists in part to shield people who don't have power and vulnerable people, and children certainly fall into that class. And there are times when children have to be protected from their parents. I wish it weren't so, but it's true. And these kinds of cases are moments when we would like – most of us I think would like to have the law do that.
What is it that makes Christian Science any different from the peculiar people or Jehovah's Witnesses in terms of their relationship between them, their children, and their faith.
Sure. I think Christian Scientists would – and Christian Scientists do – they object to being lumped in as faith healers, and they would say that's a misnomer. We are not faith healers. And officially, and I want to be fair in terms of what they say that they believe, they believe that disease is mental, that it's a disease is a problem of the mind, and if it's a problem of the mind, it can be cured through the mind. And so disease, the way to cure disease is through right thinking, as articulated in the teachings of Mary Baker Eddy.
And her own experience, apparently.
Exactly. And so I think that they would say it's not exactly faith healing, but I think that that's splitting hairs somewhat. And I actually think that their sensitivity about that particular issue is more political than it is practical. It's more political than it is sort of straightforward. It's about them not wanting to feel they just don't want to get lumped in with presumably disreputable faith healing types, because the Christian Scientists have – they've been just incredibly successful at portraying their faith as a sort of wholesome, respectable mainstream.
Does it not exclude medical treatment for children then?
Officially, I want to be fair about how I articulate this. Christian Scientists would say and have said publicly there is nothing in the – there is no policy or tenet of faith or whatever you want to call it that prohibits Christian Science parents from taking their children to see doctors. They are officially not barred from doing that as being Christian Science. And that's – if you scratch one inch below the surface of those statements, you'll know that that's – in truth, what happens is Christian Science parents feel an implicit bar. They feel like it's widely known that it's something that you're probably not supposed to do as a Christian Scientist.
So
– you will be treated differently as a Christian Scientist if you say, well, you know, I took my kid to the emergency room yesterday and, you know, I don't want to be unfair, but I've talked to numerous former Christian Scientists. I've read about this. And one of the things that disturbs me about the public discourse about this is I do think that there is a degree of disingenuousness that
– they're misrepresenting themselves.
I think that that's an accurate way.
Could it be that there's a spectrum of those who practice a sort of extreme form versus those who don't? To the way within just about any of the denominations, whether it's Lutheran or something else, there's such a range of
– it's interesting.
Practice.
You know, I've written about the Amish, right? And the Amish, boy, there are – for as many Amish communities as there are sort of different ways of going about stuff. And I really think though for Christian Science, my understanding of what happens in Christian Science communities is that if you want to be a Christian – if you want to be accepted as a Christian Scientist, you have to repudiate medicine.
Even if your appendix ruptures.
Even if your appendix ruptures.
Can you say something about some of the cases, the legal cases that have involved Christian Scientists?
Boy, where
children?
To begin? My book was 10 chapters long, and two of the chapters are about Christian Scientists because there are so many cases. And they range from – to me, the most tragic of the cases involve young Christian Scientists who really come down with garden variety, you know, ailments that most pediatricians would be able to diagnose and treat fairly easily, things like juvenile diabetes, cases of stomach blockages and so forth, and things that aren't exotic, difficult to treat, hard to diagnose. And that's – to me, that's one of the real tragedies of this is that they are – you mentioned the – I quoted someone saying that they're pointless and these deaths are pointless and preventable, and they really are. I mean – the ailments that these children die from – I wrote about one case. It didn't involve a Christian Scientist, but a child who choked on a banana. And the parents did, rather than attempting to perform the Heimlich on the child, just called in the – you know, called in people and prayed, and the child expired just choking on a banana.
Don't really have time to have a conference when somebody's choking.
And the father had actually gone to medical school for a year before his life had gone a different direction. He joined this other – church. And so we see that sometimes, again, to go back to my point about this, there being some disingenuousness, you'll hear faith healers say, and this is in legal cases, parents who are put on trial will frequently say, wow, this case was really complicated. We're not even really sure that a doctor could have figured this out anyway. So we really couldn't, we really shouldn't be held legally responsible because there's no saying that medicine could have called, that it would have made a difference. Boy, nine times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, that's absolutely not the case. These are things that really can be treated if they're detected and the child is taken to a doctor.
Can the church be held liable? It seemed to me there was one case. I don't remember.
There was a civil case involving a boy named Ian Lundman in Minnesota. And I won't bore you with the details of it, but eventually the father of the deceased boy, who was estranged from his ex-wife, the wife was a Christian Scientist, and the child who had died had been treated by various Christian Scientists. The father sued a whole slew of people, including the Christian Science Church, and initially won an enormous civil judgment against the Mother Church of Christian Science. I mean, the church itself, that was knocked down. The award against the church itself was thrown out on appeal. Some of the individual awards were allowed to stand. I want to say the figure was a $10 million judgment. It was an enormous judgment against the church. And lots of people were mortified by the idea that a church could be held accountable for the implications of its teaching and the people who sort of operate under the orbit of the church and what they do. And that's – we've never had another case quite like that. I think it's possible. I think it's possible. And certainly the Christian Science Church would be the only church worth suing. I mean they have – deep enough pockets that just as a practical matter, you wouldn't want to sue some rundown little church with, 20 members. They just don't have any assets. And this is one of the reasons why the Christian Scientists would make an inviting target.
When you mention large church versus small church in the context of suing, it also raises an interesting question that would seem to make this even more difficult, and that is defining what is faith and what is neglect. I mean, for example, if somebody is just whatever too lazy to take care of their children and the children suffer for it, what's to stop the parent from just saying, well, that's my belief,
that I
shouldn't intervene whether they a priori had that belief or not? I mean, it sounds like very murky territory.
It is, and I think that in most cases we are dealing with people who are acting on the basis of a specific belief and within the context of a specific tradition. As a legal matter, just being lazy and saying I didn't feel like treating my kid is much more cut and dry than it is to say I in fact did not treat my child, but I have a religious reason for doing so. Because we have in many states, including Wisconsin, now we have these provisions in our abuse and neglect laws that appear to shield parents who act on religious grounds. You don't sort of have a religious or laziness shield law, but we do have, and there's a debate going on in Wisconsin as we speak about the extent to which the law should protect these kinds of practices, specifically in the context of child health. It's still unresolved. I mean, you would think, right? We've had these cases since, I'm talking to the peculiar people, 1850s, and here we are. Still not clear.
One of the things that troubled me reading about some of the cases is the way that if you assume that you can – that the disease is a matter of the mind not working hard enough or the inappropriate faith, and that's why you have this disease. Some of the children who had various tumors and – awful diseases were in great pain, were made to feel that it was a sign of their sin. This link between sin and disease is kind of – I just think of how much that would add to your sense of suffering if you were dealing with some physical problem.
Oh, absolutely.
As if the devil somehow is responsible for imperfections or maladies of any sort.
Or that your own – that your – your physical shortcomings are a manifestation of your spiritual shortcomings.
And it seems linked to some of the sort of exorcisms and other practices.
Sure. Absolutely. And that's an interesting question. I mean, if you – one way to look at it would be to say, well, I was sort of possessed by the devil or the spirit of the devil has sort of taken over and I'm powerless to do that. But to have that discussion about a child who is an infant is – I'm not sure how that – really, how can the child itself – and this is obviously much more of a theological question than it is a legal question, but how can an infant be held responsible for sinfulness? And then you have parents also feeling guilty in those sort of circumstances, saying, well, it obviously could not be my child. Perhaps it's me. Perhaps it's something that I've done as a parent, and my child is being punished physically for my spiritual.
How would a case tend to play out? I mean, let's say in this country, let's even narrow it down to Wisconsin if you want. Again, sort of a classic case where we'll say a neighbor sees something that's life-threatening going on for a child whose parents are not intervening. What recourse does the neighbor have, and or any concerned person, and how is it likely to play out?
Well, oftentimes I would say if you were asking me to describe a typical case, it would be the child dies. Then a neighbor, the parents, whomever reports the death. It's very rarely are the illnesses of the children really reported to authorities. If that happens and the child is alive, social services can take the child into protective custody. And that's actually not especially difficult to do. But typically that isn't what happens at all, because the neighbors don't find out until there is a death. If that happens, you'll have a sort of half-hearted investigation and prosecution that
– probation probably.
Well, yeah. And as prosecutors, I mean, they don't see these cases very often. They don't really think about these laws until the cases drop into their laps. And they look at the law and say, wow, the law in my state is somewhat confusing. In Wisconsin – and this isn't – I mean, in Wisconsin, we had a notable case over the last 2 years involving parents in the Wausau area. The Newmans, the death of this young woman, Kara Newman. And our law, we apparently have in Wisconsin an exemption in our child abuse and neglect laws for these kinds of practices. The prosecutors in Marathon County decided to do an end run around that law. And rather than charging the parents with abuse and neglect, they charged them with second-degree reckless homicide, which is our version of manslaughter. And the parents were found guilty under those charges, and then their sentence was – sort of characteristically not very severe. They were sentenced to terms of 6 months, but to be spread out over 6 years. So it was
a day here, a day there.
A month a year for the next 6 years. As the case was going on, you know, my book had come out before this case started. And when asked, I said, this is the way this is going to turn out. And it has turned out exactly the way I thought it would. And not because I'm smart, but just because there's this pattern that happens over and over and over again. In that case, the Newman case is far from over. They're appealing their convictions, and they are going to argue that Wisconsin law is so confusing that their right to due process of law was violated. I mean, on one hand, we appear to have an exemption for these kinds of practices. But on the other hand, they were charged under a different statute that doesn't appear to sanction. So which law are they supposed to believe? As a legal argument, that's a very good argument to make. Sometimes attorneys get jazzed up about making a First Amendment argument, saying, wow, this is, you know, this conduct should be protected because it's religious, and, you know, doesn't everybody love the First Amendment? That doesn't.
Easier to bag it on a technicality. Nah.
Well, the law is technical. I mean, that's why we have it. And it is – due process of law is a fancy way of saying just sort of basic fairness. If you have two laws that conflict with one another, we can't assume that the average citizen is going to know which one to follow and which one not to follow. And that's why our legislature does need to resolve that apparent conflict in the law. It's attempting to do so now. I mean, we have sort of competing revisions of the law being worked out in the legislature right now.
Well, the thing you said that says that there's an exemption for religious grounds for parents, does it put any limits on it? I mean, surely it doesn't say that anything goes.
It's in Chapter 948, which outlines crimes against children. And it, in a legalese sort of way, says that parents can't really be found guilty of abuse and neglect if they engage in a spiritual – and this is my summary of it. They can't be found guilty of abuse and neglect if they are engaging in a legitimate faith healing ritual.
Really?
That's what that says. Chapter 948.03 parenthesis 6. That is what is really what that appears to say. There's never really been a case in Wisconsin to fully flesh out what the limits of that could be. And that's certainly one of the things that's going to happen, I think. Of course, the Newmans weren't charged under that law, but the specter of it hangs over their case. And unfortunately now there are competing provisions in the legislature, one of which was introduced by State Senator Lena Taylor of Milwaukee that ostensibly revises that Chapter 948.03 parenthesis 6, that faith healing treatment through prayer. And it says treatment – it's headed treatment through prayer in bold print. That's what it's called. And unfortunately, Senator Taylor's revision only makes it worse – in my opinion, only makes it worse. It actually – she's worked with the Christian Science Church and they're revising the law in a way that actually will only make it harder to prosecute parents in these cases and will actually only further muddy what's already a kind of confusing statute.
There has to be a little bit of a gradient though from, let's say, a case in which the parents simply neglect to treat something ongoing like diabetes on the one hand. A step up from that would be parents who refuse to have their child treated if he or she has been struck by a car, let's say, something more immediate like that. And a case where in an act of attempted faith healing or somehow casting out demons, the parents are actually inflicting corporal punishment on the child.
Well, I think that legally all those three things are not dissimilar from one another. The argument that's made is on the low end of the scale. It's a common cold. Does this mean if there's no exception for faith healing, does that mean I could be prosecuted if I don't take my child immediately to the emergency room?
Right.
And I appreciate that as a rhetorical strategy. It's a ridiculous practical matter because the law would never be enforced that way. It is a good question. When legally is the illness severe enough that there has to be immediate action to provide a specific medical remedy? For the three things that you've just described, it's pretty obvious that we would expect that a parent would be able to determine my child is in peril medically and therefore I need to do something immediately. Again, this is a – if you're a cagey defense lawyer, you could pick this apart forever and say, well, what was the moment? When did the behavior start becoming
counterproductive?
Criminal. When was it a crime and when was it not a crime? Mm-hmm. And we can – you know, we could certainly get there eventually if the law – but we could never even get – you can't even have that discussion in Wisconsin now because the law really – I think it gives parents free rein to deny their children medical treatment based on their religious beliefs and practices. And I've
– And getting freer, you say.
If the measure sponsored by Lena Taylor passes, it would be impossible to convict a parent of religion-based medical neglect in the state of Wisconsin. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind. I've studied 150 years of this stuff. It would never under that bill – it would never happen. And if that's – as a matter of public policy, if the legislature and the people of Wisconsin decide that that's what they want, then okay, they've decided that they never want to prosecute parents successfully. I actually don't think that that's what the people of Wisconsin really want. But the conversation that we're having about this publicly in Wisconsin is very distorted and incomplete, and people are afraid to talk about regulating religion because it's this sort of third rail issue where no one wants to be perceived of as being anti-religious. And I can appreciate that, but we're talking about conduct that harms children who are defenseless. And to me, if I had to choose between which one of those things I cared more about, I care more about protecting children than I care about protecting religious conduct. I wish we could have both. I wish you could do whatever you wanted in the name of religion and everything would be fine. But when that conduct really infringes, and I don't mean in a sort of theoretical way, I mean that the conduct kills somebody else, then I think it needs to be regulated. I don't think that that's really an extreme
The child
position.
Is more fragile than the religion.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Some final thoughts on Jehovah's Witnesses and other cases involving religious faith healing and the law when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Sean Peters, and we're looking at the phenomenon of children, faith, and the law. We haven't mentioned one issue that comes up still, I think, fairly often. That is the right to withhold a transfusion based on religion.
Sure. And this comes up in the context of Jehovah's Witnesses. Jehovah's Witnesses wouldn't really be lumped into that category of faith healers at all. But they have a specific, what they claim to be a scriptural prohibition on the eating of blood as described in Leviticus. And it becomes an issue not so much, again, for adults, right? If you're an adult and you believe that you have a religious objection to receiving a blood transfusion, generally that's okay. But what happens when a child, when a parent decides that the family's religious beliefs prohibit the child from receiving a blood transfusion? And these cases become even more complicated when it's a pregnant woman who wants to deny herself a blood transfusion. Because on one hand, again, as we've said, if you're a competent adult, the courts have generally said you can do what you want, or we're not going to compel you to have treatment. But courts struggle with that in the case of pregnant women because they want to consider the rights of the fetus. And that's a very interesting legal question, is does a fetus have a right to medical treatment?
At what point does it constitute an individual? For one thing, that makes it complicated enough. At one point, is it distinct enough from its mother to have individual rights?
Exactly. And I mean, I feel fairly confident saying that a fetus doesn't have legal rights until the fetus is born. And that's one way of looking at it. But the courts, that's a very unsatisfactory way of saying that in this kind of context. And courts they've sort of come out all over the map in cases like this where they will figure out a way to compel that transfusion in the pregnant woman to protect the rights of the fetus. In some cases it has happened, in some cases it has not. But it just sort of underscores, it just adds another layer of complexity to this issue where it's already sort of confounding. And then you throw in, I mean, if you think religion, law, and politics are a hot potato, throw in another one with reproductive rights and you have another one. I wrote about that some in my book because it adds a further sort of layer of complexity.
You even talk about one woman where the state more or less, I guess, almost imprisoned her or put her in a situation where she had to give birth in their care so that she would give her newborn better care than she had given previous children.
This was in Massachusetts. A woman had belonged to a small sect called The Body, and she had been involved in a legal proceeding that resulted from the loss of some children, and she appeared in court pregnant, and the local prosecutor said, "Well, wait a minute. I'm not going to let another child die, so I'm going to preemptively incarcerate this woman because I think that in the future she will neglect this child. She will have a botched home birth. Presumably that is what had happened with some of her other children." And he said, I'm not sure if this is legal, but I don't care because I will lock her up long enough that we know that she'll have this child under medical supervision." And that's what happened in Massachusetts. And boy, I mean, again, and I've thought a lot about these cases, and I on one hand, you want to preserve people's legal rights and you want to sort of take actions that are consonant with our legal and constitutional traditions. But then you sort of – oftentimes we just want to cut through that. You want to say, let's just do the thing that is going to save
and worry
a
about
life
the legalities later.
Later. And that, and the prosecutor in that case said that, and it was a moment of candor that I sort of appreciated at the time.
Do you see, if you look in the aggregate in review here, if you look at all this kind of body of cases over the last however many decades, do you see any kind of direction that they're taking toward greater rights for the parents, greater legal intervention opportunities, or is there any kind of a drift to it all?
You know, you would think that there would be we sort of have this Whig sense of history where things get better and better and better. I actually don't, and I think in part this might sound sort of unusual, but I think partly because of the information revolution and the rise of the sort of accessibility of information and different ideas on the internet, that we're actually the potential to see more claims based in religious faith has grown. More and more people are plugging into ideas and becoming involved in religious traditions that they might not otherwise have been exposed to. And I think skepticism of medical science has taken a turn, I'd say, in the last 10 to 15 years. Those two things together indicate to me that these cases will not go away anytime soon. We're going to see different kinds of arguments being made. We're still going to have religious practices, and we're still going to have parents engaging in religious healing rituals. That's really not going to go away. We're going to have people justifying it, I think, in different ways now, and we're seeing that. I think just even since my book has come out, I've seen different things come up where the sort of internet – people being connected to internet ministries, for instance. And that's something that, you know, 20 years ago you didn't have that. Religion is interesting in that it's elastic and it changes and it evolves over time. And so this is it's an issue that's been around. The fundamental sort of state power versus individual rights thing is something that's been around forever. It's going to manifest itself in different sort of unexpected ways over time.
We'll have to have you back to see what's happened in
sure.
some cases and a few years from now. Our guest has been Sean Peters. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.